Ambassador and scholar Rick Barton discusses America's role in foreign crises. One of the central debates of U.S. foreign policy is when to get involved in hotspots around the globe, and in what way. Today's world is complicated and messy, and recent interventions, including Iraq and Afghanistan, have been fraught with problems. Now, as the U.S. and the United Nations debate the proper response to conflicts in places such as Syria and Central America, Ambassador Rick Barton has written a new book. Peaceworks argues for the U.S. role in what he calls building peace. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we talk with Rick Barton about what his experience as a diplomat in some of the most difficult places in the world has taught him, and how he believes our nation must navigate future conflicts. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A civil war in Syria, a resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan, unrest in Venezuela, a rising tide of authoritarian regimes, and seemingly the intractable problem of how to help millions of refugees. These are only a few of the issues making international news headlines. Today, my guest, a former diplomat, foreign policy expert, and State Department advisor who has written a book on the role of the U.S. in a turbulent world. Rick Barton currently teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. He served as an American ambassador to the United Nations, and he is a Mainer. His new book is Peaceworks, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World. Ambassador Barton, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What role do you think the United States should play in international affairs? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I want to start with a very basic question about the United States' role in the world. And you write in your book that today Americans must, quote, redouble their efforts to expand world peace. You write, America First has a ring to it, but the central role the United States plays in a larger events renews our strength. Why? Why must our country, in your view, continue to be involved in crises in other countries?
Well, first off, it works for the United States. World peace is good for America. The fact that there have not been any big wars in the last multiple decades has been one reason that the United States economy has grown, that many of our life indicators have improved. And so it's in our own interest, but we're also the most advantaged country in the world. It's not that we're better or we're smarter, but we have many, many, many advantages. And when you have that advantage position, you can actually make a difference. If we put our minds to something, we can actually bring change in the world, which is not true of the vast majority of the countries in the world. So it's really that the advantageous position we have, the fact that it has worked to our benefit, and that there is a great need. There are plenty of situations in the world that need some outside assistance, not to be taken over. This is not a book that argues the United States should take over these places. In fact, it argues that we need to be much more coherent and much more effective and really be more catalytic and rely more on local people than on the big imports of the United States.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. You want the U.S. role to be that as a catalyst. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we've really gotten stuck in just so many places. And there are some formulas that I offer up in the book. But the way that you can normally be most helpful when somebody else has a problem, and this is true in our personal lives as well, if there's a member of your family and that person seems to need help and you offer the help but they haven't asked for it or they haven't really shown a great desire, the likelihood of your help having any value whatsoever is nil. Why would it be any easier in a distant land with people killing each other to come in and say, fellows, I've got a pretty good idea here. of this is how things should go from here on in because the United States is helping out. So catalytic is to me is a very realistic role. If somebody is ready, and so ripeness is part of the problem. If they're ready for your help, and you come at the right time with the right goods, and you do it in a sensitive way, not arrogant, but rather kind of a humble way, you have a chance at helping out, but this is still venture capital.
Would you say that our experience in Iraq is the opposite of what you mean as a catalyst?
Absolutely. I mean, we not only did we it was a war of our own choosing. There wasn't a huge – there were obviously people in the country that would be happy to get rid of Saddam Hussein. But that was not – that's not the only defining quality there. And then we really got stuck thinking that we were going to build a shining city on a hill. And that's also not realistic. We don't even build that many shining cities on our own hills in our country, let alone taking over an entire economy and the social life of a place that we barely understood. And we had almost no Americans who spoke the language or really were well grounded in the history or the being or the social life of the place.
There are a lot of people that argue that the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan and then also in other places such as Libya is a real illustration of why we ought not to get involved in these messy conflicts in places like the Middle East and Asia. And I'm wondering if you ascribe to that sort of read of recent history.
I don't. I mean, I think it's. I would agree that those are two mistakes. But I think that, for example, if we use a really simple test, do we know 100 people in the place? That's about as basic a test as we could put forward. We would find in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that we did not really know 100 people before we went in there. That would be my minimal standard for sending U.S. troops into a place. You would like to think that we knew something about their history, that we were just were familiar with their culture. We don't have that kind of background either. So these are places where we had choices to make, and we didn't make particularly good choices. I think we rushed into them, and even some of the commanding officers, the generals that ran the that have run the war in Afghanistan said that we probably should have not rushed in there the way we did. And then we gave ourselves the feeling that we'd won the war, but then we lost the peace over the next 15 years.
It's interesting, though, because you write about Syria, that we missed the moment. So it's a balance, isn't it? When do we wait and assess the situation, and when is there a sense of urgency?
And what, you know, when I started out, there was a scholar named Bill Zartman, who used the standard of ripeness, sort of like the melon in the supermarket, and he would say you have to wait for the ripe moment, and I ascribed to that. And then the Syria war came along, and it was really kind of different because there was almost not a ripe moment, the perfect time to enter, and so I had to add a second criteria, which was inevitability, that if we didn't do something, the likelihood of hundreds of thousands of people dying and of an entire region being destabilized. And we had some important allies in that region, Turkey, Israel, Jordan, among others. And Lebanon is almost half refugees at this point. And, of course, the refugee overflow into Europe. But so I think you have to – it is extremely delicate, and you cannot – it cannot be formulaic. But, again, you shouldn't rush into these places.
When you say we missed the moment in Syria, what was the moment? When could we have possibly averted the humanitarian disaster that has become?
I think the largest cause of the humanitarian disaster and the thing that troubled the Syrians that we worked with most was the bombing and the incessant and totally unpredictable bombing, whether it was barrel bombs from helicopters or missiles or shelling from miles away. That particular act and sort of bedlam from the sky was what caused the greatest number of deaths and refugees and really the fact that over half the people in Syria no longer live in their homes. So I believe that that was what we probably could have intervened on to lessen the bombing. I think that if we had threatened the Assad regime with any time you bomb a school, a hospital, a civilian population, there will be an immediate response to that. We're not looking for this. So you get to decide how often the bombs are going to hit your palaces, your airstrips, or take out your military might. Because on the ground, the Assad regime was not winning. The popular revolt was actually stronger on the ground. But it was the difference was the aerial war, and then of course the Russians joined in as well. And then later on, the United States also became a major bomber. So it's been, I think the bombing had really changed the whole dynamic on the ground.
You write that early on when the Obama administration was trying to figure out how to respond to Syria, you do not believe that the president was given enough imaginative ideas, imaginative solutions. And this is really a thread throughout your entire book. And I think any of us who are familiar with bureaucracies can relate to your frustration with bureaucracies and groupthink and you know, always having done things one way, so continuing to do that another way. Is there a change going on within those that you know in the diplomatic corps, in the military, to come up with more creative thinking about these, you know, one after another trouble spots in the world?
I don't think it's institutionalized yet, and this is one of the problems with the kind of the obesity of American institutions. This is not just true of our government. Obviously, if you asked almost any one of your listeners how are you doing with your cable TV company or your health insurance company or your mortgage company, they would probably be equally despairing. So there's some problem with bureaucratic size. But also the national security community is not one that's all that comfortable with risk. They're working in the riskiest places on earth, but they're trying to reduce the sort of the exposure to risk. And I think you have to embrace the likelihood that you're going to fail oftentimes. That's why I like the phrase venture capital, that if one or two out of 10 of your initiatives work, you've actually been pretty darn successful. That's not bad. And you have to assume that in other places you haven't had much of an impact. And that's hard to go to the U.S. Congress. It's hard to go to the people. On the other hand, if you were an investor and you said, and by the way, I bought Apple Computer and Google 10 years ago or 15 years ago, you'd look like a genius. You don't have to talk about the 15 or 20 companies that don't even exist any longer.
But you full well know before you were a diplomat, you were involved in politics. And, you know, no politician is going to stand on a debate stage and say, I'm really hopeful we'll succeed in 1 in 10 interventions.
Well, but I think the American public is actually a lot more sophisticated than that. I mean, they recognize that, you know, you can have 5 kids and they don't all go to MIT. They don't all become Olympic athletes or whatever it happens to be. So People see that in their own lives, and that's why I think you've got to continue to relate these global problems back to the way we deal with them on a practical, local level, because that's the way you will get the public engaged. People are somewhat fascinated by the complexity of these problems, but generally when I get asked about what's going on in Syria, people want to find a handle. They can't sit there and listen to me for several hours talk about the intricacies of the war. They want to see, okay, so how might we do something, or what's my role, or what's the American interest?
Well, it's funny you say that, because that was going to be my next question to you. I was going to return to Syria and say, now that we talk about having missed a really opportune moment, now that we are where we are, or the world is where it is with Syria, what is the U.S. role today? What would you like to see our president saying and doing?
Well, I think that these problems get harder and harder. I remember Ed Muskie sitting next to him at a dinner here in Maine once and asking him about Central America. And he said, the problem is that these things don't get better with age. And so there are fewer and fewer options as you go on. And I think there's some truth to that. Obviously, the fatigue of war, all the people there are dead tired. They could care less about the conflict. They've had it, and they want to move on. But I do think that the bombing, it remains the central question, and that's the fact that everybody has chosen to fight that their wars, their own individual wars, whether it's against ISIS or whether it's against the revolution by bombing, that has to be addressed, and it also has a direct impact on the humanitarian standards. Almost everybody on Earth agrees that there are certain humanitarian standards, that there should be free access of humanitarian assistance to anybody who's suffering from this kind of situation. That has not been the case in Syria, despite the fact that even the Security Council and Russia and China have supported those resolutions. So I think reestablishing one or two global standards, in particular the humanitarian standards, could open up some freedom of movement, which would then probably be about as close to an opening, a political opening, as we could find today. But it's a pretty desperate situation.
So when you say some movement, some ability for humanitarian groups to get aid into the country?
Yeah, because it's always been very much restricted by the Assad regime. They've insisted on most of the assistance, the UN assistance, had to come through Damascus, and then they decided where it went. And that, in turn, created a very warped playing field.
Mm. One of the positions you've held is as Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees at the UN. Mm-hmm. As you follow the Syrian refugees and others, I'm wondering if you're worried about the future, and specifically the prediction that we're going to see millions and millions of climate refugees as places on Earth become unlivable. And how does the world and how does the U.S. plan for this?
Well, the United States has really been the leader in migration issues and refugee issues, the single largest contributor to the two international organizations that are really address these issues, the International Organization for Migration and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And that we're both the biggest financial contributors, but we're also the people that have been most supportive of the treaties. And historically, we've taken a pretty generous share of resettled people who had already stopped in another country. But there are a lot of Americans who think we take millions of refugees, and actually the millions of refugees generally go to the immediate neighboring country. So when Afghanistan is in war, Pakistan and Iran capture most of the refugees by far. And the same thing is happening, obviously, in the Syrian war. Most of the refugees are in Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, some in Iraq as well. So we've helped out by making financial aid our number one. We've been the number one contributor. So we believe in these organizations, and because they've also helped us to, in a way, contain the problem in a more local way. But of course, what happened in the Syrian war, and to some extent in the Bosnian war, and I know you did some work on that way back as well, is that refugees started to make it into the Western countries, and Germany in particular took a fairly large number of people from both Syria and Bosnia, because they needed the labor as well, and their populations were aging. So there's always been an advantage to taking people. And even in a state like Maine, which is the oldest state in the country by population, you do need inflows of younger people, and that obviously these can be very, very talented people.
We're talking with ambassador and scholar Rick Barton. His brand new book is called Peaceworks, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. and Freemasons in Maine supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Most teachers in America have worked a second job to make ends meet.
When you have 15 years experience and two master's degrees and you're not making $40,000, that's an issue.
As educators walk off the job and schools close in Arizona, we'll ask what teachers really think about their working conditions. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio.
Most, if not all, public radio listeners have a keen interest in what is going on around the world, and of course right here in Maine and around the country as well. The events and issues you hear and learn about affect our lives and the future. Hi, this is Charles Beck reminding you once again that this valued service, bringing you independent, trusted coverage of those events and issues, couldn't be here, wouldn't be here without your financial support. Monthly or annual contributions from you, at the level you are comfortable with, make it all possible. So we'll be here on Super Thursday, May 10th, to take your call of support. But you can get a jump start right now if Super Thursday isn't convenient. Call 800-866-1475 or contribute online at mainepublic.org. Thanks for doing your part. It's what makes it all work.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Case for Diplomacy. Joining me, former Ambassador Rick Barton. He currently teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University and has served in many diplomatic posts, including as American Ambassador to the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. He is the author of Peaceworks, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. One of the things you talk about in your book, Ambassador Barton, is that we're, and when I say we, I mean the military, the diplomatic corps, perpetually surprised. We often don't see things coming. And people are very open about this, not having seen situations as they're simmering or as they're about to take a turn for the worse. Where are areas that you're worried about right now that we may not be paying enough attention to?
Well, I think one of the areas that's probably most challenging is North Central America, actually, and because it's so close to our border, and we've been mostly neglectful of it, and we suddenly get very excited about tens of thousands of Honduran children showing up on the border of Texas, but we're not familiar with the fact that this is the highest homicide rate in the world. It's almost as high as a war zone. The same and the return of violence in El Salvador as well, and the pressure that the drug trade in combination with organized crime and gangs have brought to those societies, and the threatening of younger and younger and younger people. Our daughter's a school teacher in California now, and she has a whole group of Guatemalan indigenous people. They come from a group called the MOM, and they're prized by the drug trade and by gangs because they don't grow very tall. So a 12-year-old boy might look like he's seven. And that makes him kind of a very useful runner. But essentially, they're imprisoned at an early age, and used as part of this dangerous business. And then their lives are at risk the whole time. So their parents naturally run. So I think North Central America, the way we've been talking about Mexico and we treat Mexico, that's a place that worries me quite a bit. Then you have, as you said, the global change issues are very big, and in particular in these heavily populated areas. And Asia, which has been very stable now for a while, has just such huge numbers of people that when anything goes wrong, you're suddenly talking about literally millions of people moving and causing great pressure somewhere else on the earth. So those would be the two that I would think about.
All right. And I have to ask you before we go to calls, what your read is on what's going on between North and South Korea right now.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm lucky because I have one of my Princeton students just did his thesis, and the title of it is More Rational Than You Think, North Korea, and where he makes the argument that actually North Korea's actions over the last several decades have been highly rational based on how insecure they felt at the time. And when they feel highly insecure, they're willing to take a lot of risks. And, of course, the way that we've been dealing with North Korea has generated quite a bit of their own insecurity, plus the changing of regimes of generations of leaders. And that's also a high level of insecurity. But I think the key issue for me on the Koreas is what does South Korea think? Because if anything goes wrong there, they're the country that's going to lose 5, 6, 10 million people. And so South Korea really gets the call. Right now you have a popular president in South Korea who is willing to take the risk on reaching out to North Korea, and it's working for him politically. And so the United States has got to be careful not to mess that up. And generally we've taken our lead from South Korea, no matter how much we kind of position ourselves as being the deciders in this place.
We'll go to Robin, who's calling from Pembroke. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Ambassador Barton, for coming to Maine Calling. My daughter's a student at Woodrow Wilson. I wanted to ask about what the situation in Jordan. It seems like Jordanian society is taking the brunt of the Syrian refugee crisis with increasing stresses on Jordanian society. I wonder if you feel as if the U.S. could be doing more, or whether we're doing enough to help the Jordanians with that situation.
Well, thanks, Robin. I'm not sure if I've had your daughter in my class, but is she an undergraduate senior or
a master's student?
A master's student. So in the MPA program, great. Well, I can't say that I'm a great Jordanian expert, but obviously between the Palestinian refugees and now this new influx of Syrian refugees, that the country is pretty stressed out. Jordan is one country where almost every form of U.S. assistance, military assistance, intelligence assistance, development, budget support, anything that the United States does, we do in Jordan. And I think that is potentially helpful, but my concern is that oftentimes we keep delivering what we have in the warehouse rather than what's most needed today, so that Jordan, probably the total amount of money we're spending in Jordan is quite significant for a country of that size, but we're probably doing too many things that are kind of too traditional and may not fit the current crisis or the next chapter that they need to address. And that would be my concern. We don't actually have ways of changing how we're spending our money. This gets back to something that Jennifer was asking about earlier, that we can get stuck in our ways. And that's what would worry me most about Jordan right now.
Robin, thanks for your call. We'll go to Brewer and Bruce. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
Hey, good, Bruce. How you doing? So this is one of my high school friends.
So can you think of any event in the history of the world that involved either a military crisis with horrific killing or a humanitarian crisis with horrific death, where the powers that were involved or had an interest actually got it right and could serve as a model for the next problem that's just around the corner, whether it be, you know, Yemen or Central America.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a chapter in the book, Bruce, where I try to reflect back on some of the successes of the United States. So generally, we would say that when we won World War II, that we also mostly won the peace, and both in Japan and Germany. There's a feeling that that South Korea in particular has turned out well. In Colombia, that the Plan Colombia worked out more or less well, and even in even in the Balkan Wars, while there's still a tremendous amount of instability, that the daily killing stopped. So if you accept that improvement is one standard that you would accept, then I would say that things have gotten better in those places, even though we made plenty of mistakes in those places as well. And then we did some enlightened things. For example, in Japan, John Dower, who wrote a wonderful book called Embracing Defeat, is an academic. He described how MacArthur wanted to rewrite the Constitution of Japan in a week, which, that smacks of a certain arrogance. And he said so. He had a group of Japanese expats and others who were there helping to redraft the Constitution of Japan. And it turned out that a young Japanese American woman, had come up with the idea that there should be an equal rights amendment for Japan. This was decades before the United States was unable to create an equal rights amendment, and the Japanese men in the room all opposed it. But she insisted on it, and MacArthur or his deputy, the general who was in charge of writing the Constitution, said, well, let's give it to her. So Japan actually has an equal rights amendment, and the United States doesn't. So there are moments of brilliance, but it's still hard to reshape anybody else's life. I mean, at the end of the day, it's their lives, and obviously the defeat and the war weariness and the weariness of the military extremes that the Japanese and the German people had to live through really created the base for much of that change, even though we were, I think, constructive and helpful. Just one, on a very personal level, my dad served in Iwo Jima as a Marine, and then he was scheduled to invade Japan. And even in his obituary, he had written that he favored the use of nuclear weapons, even though there are lots of people in the United States today who think that it was an excessive attack on civilians and could even be a war crime. But my dad essentially felt that it saved probably a million American lives to end that war. So, I mean, these are difficult calls, but I think that in many, many cases we've made the 5149 call the right way, but we've also made some gigantic blunders in particular in some of these more recent wars of the last 30, 40 years.
Bruce, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Albion and John. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I wanted to respond to some of the outlandish comments that your host has been making. First of all, I'm offended at the face of it that we spend 57% of our tax dollars on the defense. Then for him to come back and say, well, if we have success in 1 out of 10 of these ridiculous ventures, then that's pretty good odds.
Okay, John, wait right there. Are you talking about military ventures or diplomatic ventures?
Absolutely.
Or both? No, John, I'm asking our guest that. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about the military ventures. In fact, I hope you'll have a chance to read the book. And one reason I titled it "Peace Works" is because I do think that we've got to be much, much, much more selective in where we send our troops. And I'm sorry that you've gotten that misimpression, but I think the book will. I'm not sure you'll agree with everything you read. I'm quite sure that will not be the case, but I think you'll find that it's an argument for more American ingenuity and greater diversity of our talents than a militaristic approach.
All right, John. And what was your second question?
I don't think you can cite one example of military intervention in the last 50 years where we could have had a success.
Yeah, I do think that there are elements of Plan Colombia, for example, that have worked. I do think that our troops in the Balkans really made a difference. I mean, it kept parties from killing each other. There was not, I think we lost one soldier in Bosnia but not from the conflict. So I think there have been examples of wise and restrained use of force. I'm not making the absolute argument that you are, but I'm familiar with it, and I think it's probably an honest disagreement.
John, thanks for your call. Before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. I'll be joined by the author of a new book on the sinking of the El Faro. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Bangor Savings Bank, dedicated to helping Maine businesses of all sizes thrive for over 166 years. Learn more at bangor.com. And Ollie's Trolley, offering private charters for weddings, rehearsal dinners, and corporate functions. Located at 1 West Street in Bar Harbor and at ollie'strolley.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham talks about understanding the present moment in American politics and life by looking at the past. He'll share examples of times when the partisan divide was bad, but people unified for the common good. Meacham's new book is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today, PBS travel host Rick Steves shares some of his most memorable experiences trekking through Europe, Central America, Asia, and the Middle East. That's coming up in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock. Here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the role of the U.S. in a turbulent world. My guest is Rick Barton. He has been a diplomat, served in many important roles, including as ambassador to the United Nations. It was social economic.
Economic and Social Council.
I've got it backwards.
Sorry.
You've also led conflict management initiatives in crisis zones from Haiti to Iraq to Nigeria and Turkey. Our conversation is welcome to you. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Rick, in your career, you've had a chance to really meet with some of the news-making leaders and work with military generals and around the world. But you say it's some of the regular people you've met in these countries that have really shaped your thinking more than anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that for the United States to be successful, and I just want to build off of that last call as well, that we really have to be on the side of the people. And too often we have... And even in the course of in Japan and Korea, we ended up kind of moving in with the elites and not really embracing the people. So we came up with policies that drifted away from the common good and drifted away from our democratic traditions, which I think is part of what John was talking about before. And so part of what I tried to do in each place that I went into, and I get to start two parts of the U.S. government, which is unusual. One was a new office in the Agency for International Development called the Office of Transition Initiatives, and the second was this Bureau on Conflict and Stabilization Operations at the State Department. And both were designed to find how we could be more effective on the central political development question of the country. So, for example, in Nigeria, Nigeria has a national narrative that violence pays. That's not a particularly good narrative for social progress. And on the other hand, we weren't going to come in with United States soldiers. We were not going to come in with a huge development programs because it's the largest economy in Africa. But we were trying to figure out what could we do that might take on that national narrative. And it's not about what the United States could do, but what might be going on already in Nigeria that we could build upon. And it turned out that Nigeria's got the most dynamic filmmaking industry in Africa, and it reaches all the way to Pakistan. It's called Nollywood, and they're essentially movies that are made in less than a week, usually for well under $50,000 a piece. And they're soap operas that then are widely distributed, oftentimes by tape. And they uh, they are the most popular form of entertainment. But also in Nigeria right now, you have television breaking through, private stations everywhere, lots of private radio stations, and they have pretty much adopted anything that's going on anywhere else in the world, such as Nigeria's Got Talent and other Survivor shows and whatnot. So we tried to figure out what is going on here that might capture the potential of Nigerians solving problems in forms other than with violence and take advantage of all of this media, pretty much traditional media, but also social media, that was exploding around the country in a very positive way. And so we ended up in a partnership with the leading director, kind of the Steven Spielberg of Nollywood, superstar director Jetta Amata. I mean, that's literally how people refer to him. He walks in the room and, how is superstar director Jetta Amata? He gets the whole treatment. And we found that helped him create a 13-week television series that was run on every station in the country, every major network in the country, that was the making of a lot of these Nollywood films, each one of them with the theme of how Nigerians solve problems without the use of violence. And so suddenly you have a country of 160 million people with just a minimal amount of U.S. funding, caring quite personally about what they could do to solve these problems on their own. So these are the kinds of options that are open to us these days. And again, it doesn't take a lot of money, and it doesn't take an invasion of another society. But it might take some of our better practices.
We'll go to Jerry calling from Powinol. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. How are you? Thank you.
Good.
For taking the call. I agree totally with the ambassador about Central and South America. Having lived there, studied, and worked for South America for about 55 years, the void that has been left since probably the Alliance for Progress has not been very good for our relationship with them. The North-South relation that was there is now much more East-West, and like I said, the void is being filled by China. I was in Panama for 4 years. The Chinese are very active there. Honduras, they want to build a canal through Nicaragua, which has its problems. But so I was just wondering if the ambassador comment about every time the U.S. pulls out of something, China fills that void. How far does this go, and how will that affect us on the world stage over time?
Thank you, Jerry. And same is true in Africa, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Chinese are investing a lot of money. But they oftentimes do things in a way that's not necessarily making them popular in these places as well. They bring in their own labor force. They oftentimes set up quite apart from the local people. So some of the criticisms that I make of the United States, kind of the "we'll do it our way" or the highway approach, the Chinese are actually stumbling into as well. I actually welcome some of their investment, because these places need a lot of investment, and the United States and the private sector are not going to invest as much as they need to, in particular the infrastructure. And if the people of a place don't have the basic infrastructure or the educational tools, then they're probably pretty well stuck in a place. So that's potentially beneficial, but I don't see the Chinese really doing a lot. They're very strong in the physical infrastructure, and they're much less involved in sort of advancing the lives of local people, other than to have better roads. They did try this before. I worked in Rwanda right after the genocide, and the stadium had been built by the Chinese, and many of the roads in the country had been built by the Chinese, and that's that was in the mid 1990s. So that did not help to bring political stability to the place, which is something we've got to spend a lot more time on. It is the development of talent and the farm system of giving local people, mayors and others, real responsibility so that they can grow, so that you actually have competitions at the national level for leadership. If the United States loses an attorney general, there are probably 100 other people who could do it if, if South Sudan loses an attorney general, they may not have another capable person for 10 years. And that's obviously is a pretty slender thread to build upon.
Jerry, thanks so much for your call. We'll go to Mary Kate, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Mary Kate. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for your program today. I like to focus on what's being done locally, and sometimes we have a tendency, I think, to throw up our hands when we see what happens on the national and international scene. But working locally, there's a lot of great peace and justice groups that come out of churches or community settings. And so, you know, I appreciate your guest's work in trying to spread the word in his own way, and I appreciate his optimism. And at the same time, I think we have to look very hard at our government and the hypocrisy, you know, all the regime. You can just go to Wikipedia and see a list of regime changes that we've been responsible for since World War II. And while my father, who was also in World War II, I respect what he said about his dad, but nonetheless, you know, we killed over 100,000 people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so I think we, even though we think we might have prevented a million lives from being lost, you know, that's all. I think what we have to do is look at what we are doing, what we should not be doing, and not try to preach to other countries. And just in terms of preaching, I am a Christian and try to follow the teachings of Christ, which say to love your enemy, and therefore, you know, I'm a pacifist. And so I think maybe it would be good for those who claim to be part of those faiths to see that the just war theory has never worked or met all the criteria and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Mary Kate. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for your call, and thanks for your work. And I do think that these local groups that have really been vigilant and dedicated are make a difference, even though it can feel like a steep climb. And you are in effect working against an industry. I mean, there is a war industry in our country, and we have to be very careful about its influence at all times. I do think that we have not done well with regime change. Again, it smacks of an arrogance that we can recraft somebody else's life. There are plenty of bad rulers out there, but I do think that we have opportunities to develop talent. And just as in our political system, we oftentimes do it from the local level up. That's something we have to do much, much more of in other countries. We tend to be when the United States involves itself in another country, it oftentimes does it as a federal government. So it's the Washington branch of the U.S. that is in another country. So it tends to think in terms of central bureaucracies and big solutions. And in many of these places, the only options that are really available tend to be smaller and more incremental. And we don't embrace those enough. So I think a lot of your work fits into that space. On the pacifist question, it's really kind of an interesting one. American history showed, in particular in Pennsylvania, where the Quakers were in charge and they were pacifists, that they were getting wiped out. And Benjamin Franklin really had to make a choice. And he led the effort to in a way militarize the defenses of the colonialists there, because there weren't going to be any Quakers left if they did not protect themselves. So we've had this debate, and I'm just not drawn to a pure ideology, but I have the same preference that you have, which is to find more peaceful ways.
Mary Kate, thanks for your call. We'll go to Mechanic Falls. And Mike, hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Jennifer. I like your show, and I'm really liking this one in particular. Question for the ambassador. Vietnam vets, of which there are thousands in name and millions across the country. Yes. When we look now, 50 years after our Vietnam War, and look where Vietnam is today, united and an economic power in Southeast Asia, how much was that because of us, or was that because of just the ingenuity and energy of the Vietnamese people themselves?
Well, I think you'd have to give more credit to the Vietnamese people. This, the Vietnam War may be one of those wars where we lost the war and we won the peace, because if anybody had said to us 40 years ago, this is what Vietnam is going to be in 40 years, we would have said, fine, that's not a bad idea. In fact, we're planning to do a family trip to Vietnam for the first time in the coming year, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. But I think you have to give, I think in almost every case, you have to give it give the maximum credit to the ingenuity of the local people, and then hope that you have had a beneficial effect. I mean, it's a little bit like a parent who takes full credit for all the wonderfulness of their child. They've had an influence and they were terribly important, but at some age, it's really their own friends and how they are tackling the world. And I think we need to look at it with the same degree of modesty.
Mike, thanks for your call. I want to wrap up by asking you, Rick, if you believe that the mood of the country and the mood of the world is heading in the direction that you want it to. I mean, we see America First here. Mm-hmm. We see a rise of anti-immigrant sentiment all over Europe. It seems as though a lot of the world is heading in the opposite direction of what you would hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's way too mixed for my comfort, but on the optimistic side, I would say that we're coming out of a century where there were 100 million deaths that were directly related to large wars, and what we have today is dozens of daily terrorist or violent actions, but we're not facing huge conflagrations. So that's an improvement. But of course, if we end up with great, say, climate pressures, we could find 50 or 100 million people being chased from their homes in no time at all. And that's and really, people moving is the first sign that something is going wrong. Almost everybody knows how to run on Earth. And if something goes wrong, you can sometimes see 400,000 people leave a small area of one part of the Philippines overnight because they're feeling threatened. So it does worry me, and obviously the political leadership needs to be more, I think, more informed. One of the key points I make in the book is if you don't know a place, and we don't generally know a place, then don't get involved with American soldiers and with other extreme models.
That's going to be the last word. Rick Barton, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Barton currently teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, has served in many diplomatic posts, including as American Ambassador to the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. His new book is called Peace Works. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.